Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. I'm Tari King, Professor of Public Engagement, and today I'm talking to Julian Tang, who is a consultant virologist and honorary associate professor at the University of Leicester. He researches respiratory viruses, how they cause disease, how they spread, and how they can be controlled, particularly focusing on aerosol and airborne transmission. He's become one of the most well-known faces on our televisions, providing expert comment around coronavirus. And we'll be talking about Julian's research. But first of all, tell me about your background. I noticed you studied zoology and medicine at Cambridge, which is my old uni as well. That's a slightly unusual combination. What made you choose that? And I can't help thinking about how well-placed you must have been, having done this, looking at viruses which jump species from animals to humans.
So basically back in the 1980s at Cambridge, you could do the fast course or the slow course in medicine. And most of us chose the fast course. The fast course is the typical two-year second MB course, but it gives you 1 year extra because you can't then go on to clinical straight away. They keep you there for 3 years to do a BA. And you could choose anything you wanted to do. So those people who did lots of sport did it in 3 years because it's a slow course to let them do their varsity sports, for example, rowing or tennis or swimming. But for the rest of us, we did it in 2 years and we had 1 year to do whatever we wanted. And some of my friends did physics, some did maths, some who were good at instruments, did music, totally unrelated to medicine. And I always had an interest in animals and in the ecology, the behavior, but also the physics of animal movement. And I found a few modules that interested me in zoology, including ecology, marine ecology, as well as biomechanics. And I wanted to do another course, paleontology, but they thought it was too much for me then.
But it's a really interesting combo. So where did you then go on from there to go complete your training?
Yeah, so in fact, I moved away from medicine and did zoology as a PhD in Aberdeen, looking at fish swimming mechanics, because I liked fish and I liked fluid dynamics. And I studied with Clem Wardle and Monty Priad, and it was very immersive in looking at just one question, like how fish swim, what's the power output, what's the dynamics of their swimming motion, how are they so efficient in turning on a pinhead without any loss of velocity or momentum. And after that, I tried applying for a postdoc in Canada in a salmon farm, but that didn't go through. And then I thought I'd better come back to medicine and actually get a proper job. So I finished clinical medicine training in Sheffield, and then I did my house jobs and went up the ladder as usual. And then by the time I got to choosing a specialist pathway, I looked at microbiology because I liked infection, but I didn't like bacteria. And then I read two books. I read Virus Hunters and Virus Hunter. And that really got me into viruses. They talked about Ebola. I read Richard Preston's The Hot Zone. I saw the movies and I thought, you know, this is great. But I still needed that foundation in microbiology. So I did microbiology for 6 months. That's the minimum that I needed for virology. Then I found this job at UCL that allowed me to do virology. And the first week I walked in at UCL, I moved from Glasgow, where I did the microbiology, down to London, which was quite a big move. And we had the Lassa fever case in the first week I was there on ICU, who had actually been in for 5 days. We didn't know about him as a malaria case. But then when he started bleeding from his various orifices, they contacted virology and they said, this doesn't look like malaria anymore. So then we did some PCR testing. And I always remember that Friday, we got this call, actually it was 4 a.m. in the morning, to my professor, Richard Tedder, who then alerted us over the weekend that we got a Lassa fever confirmed case imported from Sierra Leone. And that kickstarted a huge public health thing because we got over 100 samples going all around the hospital in different labs for malaria. But in fact, all these lab scientists and physicians have been in contact with a Lassa fever positive sample. That kickstarted a massive public health tracing campaign, even back to the waste generated by this patient when he was medevaced back from Sierra Leone via a Swiss Air flight, and all the waste from that flight had to be tracked. And I was told that, in fact, it ended up in Florida, because that's where the next stop was, and they had to go back to Florida and actually incinerate all the waste from those bins, the clinical waste, backtracking from this now new diagnosis of Lassa fever. I thought, this is great. This is why I've come to virology. And then over the next few years, we had avian influenza scares from Hong Kong, then the SARS outbreaks in 2003, and then I had a seminar with a Hong Kong professor who came to visit UCL, and he recruited me to Hong Kong. to look at some of the SARS data post-SARS. So this was 2005. SARS finished in 2003, as people know. But there's lots of data that needed to be written up. And I went there and did that with him. And we published something like 40 to 50 papers in 3 years. And that really kick-started my academic career in virology.
So the Lassa case. So remind me, what's Lassa fever? Tell me what that is.
So Lassa fever is an endemic hemorrhagic fever virus in West Africa. And particularly in the area, it's like Sierra Leone, where it's almost kind of like a seasonal infection there. And it can cause severe bleeding and death in those who are severely affected. What I found out is that, in fact, a lot of people may have it, just like in malaria zones, with a relatively mild illness. And it comes from rodent urine, rodent feces in the environment, where people live in rural environments, maybe sleep close to the floor, and they can inhale the dried up feces and urine dust from these rodents that are shedding Lassa fever virus for their short rodent lives. And there's a whole family of arenaviruses that follow the same kind of pathogenesis, life cycle, particularly in the New World in South America. There's a whole host of arenaviruses in the New World that follow this kind of life cycle pathway and exposure to humans as well.
And it's really interesting what you're saying, because, as you said, as soon as you know you've got this case, and it's very contagious, you have to do the whole contact tracing thing, which is exactly what we've been having to hear about with coronavirus. Yeah. And we'll come on to that in a minute. So I know that after you were in Hong Kong, you went to Singapore and you were working, you know, this is around the time of the H1N1 pandemic. So tell me about that. This is swine flu, isn't it? So tell me about that.
Yeah, so swine flu is the name given to it here, but it's actually it's a recombinant virus of swine avian and human adapted genes in that virus. Came out from Mexico originally, back in April 2009, totally unexected, because for the 3 or 4 years I was in Hong Kong, we were lecturing about how to prepare for an avian flu pandemic from China, the H5N1. And this was totally out of left field. So I moved to Singapore in 2008, and then the swine flu hit in 2009. And when it came out of Mexico in April 2009, we were so surprised. And then we tracked it from Singapore, the way it moved across Central America, then North and South America, and then Western Europe, and then Asia. And then it finally hit Singapore around June, July, so about 3 to 4 months later. And it was interesting because they tried to contain it like SARS 2003, and they totally failed. It's a much faster moving virus. It mutates quicker, the incubation period is very short, only 1 to 2 days, whereas SARS is like 5 to 10 days. And you couldn't tell where one infection started and another began. So isolation quarantine just didn't work at all, because by the time you identify one case, it spreads like several others already. So we gave up containment and went for mitigation, which is kind of like what we're in now for the COVID-19 pandemic, trying to not contain it anymore, just live with it and just deal with severe cases. And that's what we ended up doing with the flu pandemic back in 2009. And at one point in the early part of that containment phase, we were keeping patients in until they were totally PCR negative, which was like, you know, 5, 7, 10 days. And the patients were getting so fed up. They were perfectly well, playing with their phones or PS4s or whatever they had then, and wanted to go home. But they had to have a negative PCR test. But then after several weeks of this, we just gave up because there were so many of them coming in, all actually very well, and refusing to stay in quarantine, in containment, isolation, because they were positive, until they got a negative PCR test. So eventually, by the time it got to Australia and New Zealand, it started to kind of lose that kind of scary pandemic aura. And the next year, it became like our seasonal flu and displaced the previous H1N1 seasonal virus, which was a good thing, because that virus had actually acquired a drug-resistant mutation across the world that made it resistant to the antivirals at that time. So when the new pandemic flu came in to replace it, it was sensitive to all the antivirals that we had, except for the older ones, amantadine, remantadine. But it was also sensitive to Tamiflu, which is what they had at the time. So they stockpiled lots of that for prophylaxis treatment and post-exposure prophylaxis as well. So in a way, it was a good thing from that point of view. But clearly, there were a lot of deaths from that first year, 2009, like we saw in COVID 2020. But since then, we've actually learned to live with that virus, as I'm sure we're going to do with SARS-CoV-2.
So I think it's really interesting what you talk about. And obviously, as a geneticist, I find this completely fascinating. But viruses are evolving and changing all of the time. And as you said, so this H1N1 is actually a mixture of an avian flu and a human flu. This is happening all of the time, isn't it?
Yes. So this kind of human, pig, chicken, or water, or bird culture in the rural farming culture in China has really generated a lot of the past flu pandemics. So the Spanish flu 1918 probably wasn't from China, but then the Hong Kong flu 1968 and the Asian flu 1957 probably were from southern China, hence that kind of mixing pot image that is acquired now. And part of this is due to pigs having receptors for both the avian influenza virus, 2,3 salicylic acid, and the human influenza virus, 2,6 salicylic acid. Birds have both as well to some extent, but the pigs have, you know, almost like an equal amount of both. So it's a very good mixing vessel. And that allows it to adapt, recombine to different hosts and spread to different hosts, different populations around the world. So in fact, there are now a couple of viruses that we're looking at there as well. Of course, there's H7N9 that's emerged since 2013, I think it was. And now this G4 avian swine human flu mix that they're monitoring now in southern China, in Guangdong as well. And they found some seroconversion in some of the poultry workers there. So there is a potential for that to actually then become more transmissible to humans. And this has led to some of these so-called gain-of-function studies, looking at how nature would have to mutate the H5N1 virus in birds to make it more transmissible in a sustainable manner to humans. And they have been very much critiqued over many years, but they still went ahead and published them. And part of the reason was because they thought that they were so difficult to do and that they thought that terrorists couldn't do it. But now they're doing the same thing for coronaviruses. And this is where the controversy of the lab generated and or spread accidentally, deliberately debate has now evolved for COVID-19.
And it's not just in China. I mean, obviously, you've got MERS that arose in the Middle East. So It's the fact that you get these viruses that do make this jump to humans and to other species. And just naturally, we will slowly pick these things up.
Yeah, so Ebola is also a case in point, and HIV, a case in point. HIV came from, we think, chimpanzees, SIV, to then the local humans in those areas and the Central African countries and some of the Western Eastern countries. And we know that Cameroon and that area generates a lot of new types of HIV. So this has been going for probably decades. And if you look back at the so-called tip dating studies for HIV, it's been estimated to emerge in the human population back in the 1920s, but just hasn't percolated to the West because of the lack of transport and immigration that you see now much more globally. And a lot of these studies that have been done on those existing samples, those old samples, have been very useful in revealing how HIV 1 and 2 spread across the world via Haiti to North America, and then HIV 2 slightly more slowly from Africa to different parts of Europe and the West, with this MSM sexual practice, which is not common in Africa, but is common more so in the contemporary Western culture. So I think this has been happening with many viruses, Ebola as well, and they've all been traced back to bats and elephant caves. So again, bats are a very large repository of viruses, including coronaviruses, as well as, you know, filoviruses, Ebola, and even Marburg, we think, which is a filovirus that was first found in southern Africa. And that's also probably has a bat origin, along with MERS as well, MERS and SARS, because MERS, although it's now the immediate intermediaries, camels and dromedaries, we think it's also a bat virus as well. And bats have also harbored other coronaviruses, including the common cold coronaviruses.
And you touched on this. It's about travel. I mean, one of the biggest things with coronavirus has been travel. As soon as people start leaving the country, and it's, I find it really fascinating looking at the genetics, because you can actually see how the mutations arise in particular parts of the world and then spread to other parts of the world. And it's huge. It's the fact that things move so quickly these days.
Yeah, so we have huge numbers of phylogeneticists, viral phylogeneticists working on phylodynamics, phylogeography on these different viruses. And they can actually get samples, sequences from different parts of the world with the date that they were sampled on, and even combine them with airline passenger data and come up with a kind of phylodynamic model, phylogeographic model of how influenza, for example, spread across different countries with air flights, international air flights. And there have been a couple of studies looking at intra-seasonal or inter-seasonal influenza importations into countries, including here. We looked at some imported viruses from the Hajj or from Umrah, which may seed local outbreaks out of season. But so far, we've not seen them take. So there are one or two imported viruses, but they just haven't taken and caused a significant epidemic out of season. So there's some kind of climate control as well for seasonal influenza that doesn't allow it to become a large outbreak unless you have a totally susceptible population with a brand new novel agent like coronavirus that we're seeing, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So the thing that really drives seasonality, I think, is lack of immunity. And that drives the pandemic as well. So if you don't have a immune or cross-reacting immune population, you get these kind of outbreaks, surges of the virus. And the most common reservoir for this is newborn babies. So newborn babies, infants, toddlers, don't have this library of immunity that you get in adults after the first 6 months, once their maternal antibody transfers has faded. And then they're vulnerable to everything. So that's why you see kids from 6 months to 2 years get everything. RSV, paraflu, 1, 2, 3, human metapneuma, adenoviruses, rhinoviruses, coronaviruses. They get everything. And that's why mums and dads are in and out of hospital. And that's why the PTED is very busy in winter, because they all kind of crowd in winter. They peak in winter. And we know that in the Western countries, we see RSV peaking just before flu. And of course, they don't really offer any cross-reactive immunity. So you can have RSV 1 week and flu the next. And you see that with paraflu as well, because paraflu 1, 2, 3, 4 are different species as well. You don't get that kind of cross-reactive immunity so much with parainfluenza viruses either. So it's very crowded if you're a young toddler getting all these viruses to then give you longer-lasting immunity, because when you get to primary school and high school, you find that incidence of infection drops over time quite rapidly. And that will come with COVID as well. So once you build this large exposure, long experience of immunity from different variants and the vaccine, natural immunity and the vaccine over time will probably reduce a lot of these unusual spectrum of clinical complications that we're seeing now.
And it's interesting what you're saying about how you find different forms in different parts of the world. But before we even started recording, you were mentioning about how you find different variants in different parts of this country.
Yeah. So you can see in a totally naive population, the virus just runs riot. You've got, you know, the Kent variant. Well, you've got the Wuhan virus imported. You've got the Kent variant, the Bristol variant, the Liverpool variant with different add-ons of those mutations. You've now got the Delta imported from India, but you've got Delta Plus that's arisen in the UK. And things like the Yorkshire variant. And we're seeing elsewhere, you know, the Nepalese and Vietnam variants. Essentially, what you're seeing is a mixing pot of viruses in a population that's largely non-immune, high replication rates, generating all these replication errors and getting new mutations that then are selected for because they transmit quicker in the population, more efficiently, and you get more progeny. So you get that kind of founder effect that then just proliferates throughout the whole population, unless you have a vaccination program, which is what we're seeing now. The vaccine induces cross-reactive immunity to all these different variants, and it dampens down the whole kind of variant generating machinery, but you still get breakthrough infections because that's what viruses do. They'll actually see that vaccine imposed immunity as a selection pressure and evolve around it. And we're seeing this now. And I think this will continue with the vaccine rollout, unfortunately.
And this is why it's so important. I mean, we hear it over and over again. Get vaccinated. It's hugely, hugely important. But it's also, you still have to keep maintaining, you know, social distancing, wear your mask, just basically follow all the guidelines in terms of reducing that. Because what the virus needs, we always kind of think of it as if the virus is alive and thinking, and it's not. It's just mutating. And every once in a while, these things will get round, as you say, it'll get round the vaccines, it'll get round. So it's this whole thing about maintaining and living by the rules, even after you've been vaccinated, just to reduce that spread, isn't it?
So this is where the zoology comes in. That Darwinian evolution, selection, that background knowledge can be applied to any field. And you even see, you know, with phone memes and internet memes, this evolution, this social evolution, we can apply the same principles that, you know, Richard Dawkins spelled out very clearly in his Selfish Gene, his first book. And you can apply it to viruses very well, because viruses are very pure. They don't have any social problems to deal with. They don't have any sex problems to deal with like you see in animals. You don't really see this kind of antibiotic resistance issue that you see bacteria now driving natural selection. Antivirals are relatively ineffective. They stop viral replication at that point, but the viruses that are already there don't get destroyed. They just get eaten up by the immune system if it works. So viruses are, if like, a very pure unit of evolution and replication. And if you leave them be, or you break all the rules and don't socially distance, don't mask, just let the virus spread through the population, they will find the optimum way to spread. They don't necessarily cause more severe disease, but they transmit better and allow more people to be infected. And of course, some of them will then develop severe disease as well. So it's almost like the ultimate survival machine. I always think of, like, you know, the movie Alien and Aliens when I think of viruses, because they don't care about anything else. If you're immune and you're in the way, they'll infect you. If you have no contacts, like in total lockdown, they can't go through bricks and mortar and glass. So in a way, it's very simple, very pure. As soon as you start to mix, you open up on, say, the 9th of July, you let everyone mix indoors or even outdoors, the virus will say, well, it's a new party.
So what was some of the research that you did in Singapore when you were there?
Yeah, so in Singapore, we had access to much larger amounts of funding. We got $1 million grants, which are about £500,000. I got a couple of those, one looking at molecular epidemiology of influenza, you know, sequencing and PCR testing of clinical samples, but another one looking at how we could build an imaging system to visualize human exhale flows, because we thought that a lot of these viruses are actually aerosol transmitted. So what that means is that the virus moves with the air that you breathe out from your mouth and nose and doesn't drop to the ground under gravity. This is very controversial in infection control. People don't believe this, but in fact, they actually do, but they call it something different. They call it droplet transmission, a lot of which drops to the ground, but some of those droplets are small enough to stay in the air and be transmitted as an aerosol. And the aerosols move with your airstream. So if you can visualize your airflow from your mouth and your nose, those airstreams will carry virus to other people in that vicinity. So we tried to track this using a Schlieren imaging system, which looks at how different temperatures of air that you exhale versus the ambient air can allow you to follow the shadow, if you like, of that exhale flow until it equilibrates with the surrounding air, which is quite quick, it's about a few seconds. So we could track this movement after over about 1 meter, which is a typical conversational distance. And there's a great video of me talking to my postdoc that's online now. It's had like 20 or 30,000 hits where you can see the air coming out of our nose and mouth talking to each other just across, you know, a coffee break distance, or what I call a garlic breath distance now. And you can see that I can inhale what he's exhaling. And you know this because if your friends had garlic for lunch, you can actually smell it on their breath almost immediately. And if you can inhale that garlic breath, you're inhaling some virus that's carried with it as well. So that kind of sparked this analogy I use for COVID, because we think it's airborne as well. You've got a garlic breath distance, which is short 1 meter distance. And then I call it, the other one I call it, is the burnt toast distance. And the burnt toast distance is really when the virus fills the air, like in a closed area, like a pub or a restaurant, no ventilation. And you see this with cigarette smoke as well, where someone sitting on the other side of the pub can actually smell your cigarette smoke, smell your burnt toast, if it starts here, after several minutes. And that burnt toast distance is more of a large volume airborne transmission, where you need a certain amount of virus in the air over a large volume, you know, maybe 100 cubic meters, where people sitting there for long enough can eventually inhale, accumulate an infectious dose over time, which is much slower than if you're facing somebody across a coffee table, breathing their air all the time.
So I know you came back to Leicester in 2014. What brought you back here? What brought you to Leicester?
Yeah, so it's really, I've been out in the UK for almost 10 years, and I thought I wanted somewhere near Sheffield because that's where my parents are based. I knew about Leicester. I knew it's very had a very good ethnic mix. And I think I like that ethnicity that I've been seeing in Hong Kong and Singapore and even Canada to some extent. I didn't want to lose that. But also, I think the ethnic mix is now giving you a new angle to look at things. The immune response is maybe different. The mortality, morbidity is different. And we're now finding with COVID, which has revealed a lot of things, how immigrants have done very badly with COVID. And interesting, looking at the countries where they come from, like Singapore, India, Bangladesh, some parts of Africa, they don't see that increased mortality above and beyond the local population. So it's something about being an immigrant to these Western countries that has disadvantaged them, both, you know, socially as well as health-wise, that gives them more vulnerabilities to the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think there is something there. And, you know, one of our colleagues, Manish Puri, has been looking at this in a big way. So I think this is a very unique angle that only a few places can do this, like Leicester's one, Birmingham's another. So I'm always very more comfortable in these ethnic, high diversity areas. And that shows in some of the medicine and the research that you end up doing.
So you work looking at respiratory illnesses. We're in COVID-19 pandemic. So, I mean, it's been hugely advantageous, I think, for us at Leicester to have you here. You've been able to comment on all sorts of things around coronavirus. I'm going to start with this big one. Masks. Do they work?
Yes, they work. There are many studies showing that masks work, and there's different types of studies. There are the so-called mannequin studies, where you put the mask on a mannequin, you get the mannequin to breathe like a human, you measure what stays inside the mask, what comes out, put the mask on another mannequin on the opposite side of the room and see what goes into the mask and what stays outside the mask. So that's a very experimental way of looking at this. Other people say that that's no good, this mechanistic engineering approach is no good, you've got to do RCTs. Randomized controlled trials for masks, I think, are not good. And if you look at the data based on this, you find that, you know, N95s versus surgical masks, there's no difference, you know, which is clearly not true. So they're not wearing them properly. They're not fit tested properly. But clearly the material's different. The way they fit to the face is different. If they're not showing a better performance, there's something wrong with the study, or there's a lack of compliance, or people are getting infected from outside the study work hours, for example. And masks are not like tablets. With a tablet for an RCT, you just take it, you walk away. Take another one, you take some, have some bloods taken to monitor the pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics. With masks, you've got to keep them all the time, keep them on all the time for 8 hours, but then you've got to have a break, you've got to eat, you've got to drink. When you take the mask off to eat and drink, and you're not in an isolated area, which a lot of them are not, you can get infection during that period. It just takes literally the garlic breath distance, just a few seconds, if you're sharing a table with somebody, and they put the mask on afterwards, but the virus is already in there incubating, you will blunt the effect of any mask. So RCTs and masks, I think, are not good, despite what many other people are saying. And then you have the kind of volunteer studies. And there have been a lot of these. You get volunteers who are naturally infected with influenza or SARS-CoV-2. And Don Milton's doing a lot of this stuff in Maryland, but also he's got satellite teams in Singapore with my old team there, which we are collaborating on. And also Jonathan Van Tam did some of this with flu using his Gesundheit 2 machine, which is basically a big traffic cone that you breathe and cough into that captures all the virus from your mouth that's then pulled away by an airflow into liquid media or into solid media for large and fine droplets. And you see how much virus that breath has captured and in those droplet sizes. And what you find is that people can exhale a lot of virus, but much less than the swab that they take from the mouth will show. So typically the swab from the mouth is about 10 to the 8 viruses, like 100 million viruses. But when you breathe it out, talk it out, cough it out, you get maybe 1,000 to 10,000 viruses. So you lose about 10,000-fold of the virus you actually have in the mouth that is not aerosolized, but still 10,000 viruses when you exhale over time is a lot of virus. Like if you're sitting in the pub, every breath you breathe out, you exhale 1,000 to 10,000 viruses. And you breathe 12 to 15 times a minute, about 0.7 to 0.8 liters of air. And over 3 hours with 180 minutes of breathing, you can breathe out a lot of virus. And if it's not pulled away by ventilation or by open windows, it builds up in the air and you get what I call the burnt toast effect, where people can smell the burnt toast everywhere they sit. So that's why ventilation is so important. And we've written a kind of science comment on this with our aerosol network. And we've published quite a few papers from our aerosol network since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we're even now an honorary WHO advisory team advising WHO on how to implement these interventions, ventilation, aerosol transmission control. And that really requires a change of how we build things in the future to increase the ventilation in those buildings, but also how we can modify existing buildings to reduce that indoor aerosol risk. And now the governments are getting on board. I hear people talking about ventilation coming out of the restrictions. We need improved ventilation in schools, offices, and other indoor spaces, recreational spaces. So it's getting into the public consciousness, and that's what we're trying to do. It's not going to happen overnight. Of course not. You have to change things. Infrastructure takes time and money to change. But at least the concept's there. And if it's in the guidance, you work towards it. Just like, you know, clean drinking water has been in the guidance for decades in WHO documents. We've not got there yet in many places, particularly Africa. But because it's in the guidance, all the NGOs and governments have this goal to work towards. And that's all we're asking for. We're not saying it's going to happen overnight. But if it happens at some point, and in new builds, new hospitals, for example, then that is how we can use this experience, bad though it is, to benefit society, because this virus will be with us for decades to come, just like flu.
I remember reading somewhere, so the whole idea of hands, face, space, we needed a fourth one, didn't we, for open the window, ventilate. And that's basically what you're talking here, is we need to build that into our thinking in terms of dealing with viruses.
Yeah, so a lot of our group, which includes some of the SAGE group, actually, we should say it's actually space, face, hands. So hands are the least important way of transmitting this virus, okay, because the virus doesn't last very long on hands, and your sweat secretions kill it as well. Face, well, face, don't touch your face, but also your face includes breathing in the virus. And that's one area where the research is poor. We don't know what people breathe in. You can visualize what people breathe out with high-speed cameras, tracers, you know, hot air, warm air from the mouth and nose, but you can't see what they breathe in because they're breathing in ambient air, ambient temperatures, and you don't know when they breathe it in. So, you know, a transient run in the park could exhale virus to somebody who's walking past. They could breathe it in or not. Depends on whether, if they're breathing out as this guy runs past, they may not breathe anything in at all. Okay, so that time is important. And then the last thing is so space, face, hands, and also duration, time. So if you are exposed to a runner just running past you, there's probably no time to transmit that virus. So duration of contact is important. So the space is really the ventilation bit. So space and ventilation, face and masking, and then hands touching contaminated areas or contaminating areas with your contaminated hands, that's not really a major issue.
You gave a really nice explanation about how masks protect people.
Yeah, so if you have someone wearing a mask, you don't know whether they're infected or not, but if they're infected, that mask contains what they breathe out very effectively. They actually do mask TB patients in endemic countries whilst they're waiting out patients because that contains their bacteria. So translating that to COVID, if you wear a mask, it can reduce your emission rate by at least fourfold. Two to fourfold, depends on the cloth material that you use, but from a typical surgical mask, then that cloth mask is about two to fourfold. And there have been several studies showing this. But if you also wear a mask, if you're the opposing person, the recipient, if you like you're sitting across a coffee table or a desk from somebody who's wearing a mask, when you wear a mask, you also multiply that protection because the incoming aerosol that's already been reduced by that person wearing a mask in the first place hits your mask, and that's further reduced if it's the same kind of material by another fourfold, two to fourfold difference. So in fact, the combined protection is multiplicative. It's anything from like 4 to 16-fold reduction in the amount of virus you might be exposed to. So if the source, for example, is exhaling 1,000 viruses per breath, he or she's wearing a mask to contain that, and that reduces that 1,000 viruses by fourfold, 250 viruses, for example. If you're wearing a mask and on the receiving end of that, and your mask reduces that incoming 250 viruses by another fourfold, it's reduced down to just 60 viruses. So going from 1,000 viruses to 60 viruses, or 10,000 viruses to 600 viruses, that's still a massive reduction in that fold exposure. And that's how masks work. That's why universal masking works so well in Southeast Asian countries that are like Taiwan, Vietnam, Hong Kong, that have really done very well at controlling the virus because everybody masks voluntarily. They have none of this kind of argument that masks don't work. Yes, they do. No, they don't. I don't want to wear one. They do it automatically there, and you can see the benefit. They've had hardly any viruses, hardly any infections, hardly any deaths, compared to the Western countries where they've had hundreds of thousands of deaths.
We often describe the idea that so we have viruses emerging and we are trying to counteract them. And it's almost like this sort of arms race that we have going on. So we have changed that to some extent in that we now have got the ability to immunize people. But that's not the whole picture, is it? Immunization, the immunity doesn't last. So I suppose what I'm thinking of here is that we're about to open up the country. What's your thinking on that?
Yeah, so throughout the ages, modern virology, vaccinations have always been the main way to control the virus infection, going back to, measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis B, chickenpox in some countries, not the UK. Polio, one of the earliest vaccines, worked very well. Polio is virtually eradicated in the majority of countries, measles as well. But new vaccines like rotavirus vaccine, human papillomavirus vaccine for cervical cancer, and now the COVID-19 vaccine and the flu vaccine, especially in primary schools as well, this is the way to control virus infections. Smallpox was eradicated by vaccination and tracing and isolation, quarantine. So vaccines do work to some extent, but they're not 100% effective. Why? Because some people refuse. Some people just don't respond. I've had the flu vaccine where I tested myself after the flu vaccine and I didn't respond that year. Some people actually fail the vaccine and don't know it because we don't test people post-vaccination routinely. And we know that from epidemiological studies, about 5 to 10% of people who get vaccinated actually don't respond. And also, the variants will be selected over time to actually escape the vaccine, because that's what viruses do. If they want to survive, which they do, viruses survive by adapting and mutating around existing barriers. And that's what is going to happen with COVID as well. And we see that with flu every year. The problem with flu vaccines and COVID going forward is that surveillance is done, but you need to manufacture the vaccine. And by the time it's manufactured and distributed, the virus may have changed some more. So you're always behind the virus when you're doing surveillance, manufacture, and distribution by at least 4 to 6 months. Even if the mRNA vaccines are more rapidly adaptable, you still have to actually make them in large bulk, for 60 million people or 600 million people, and distribute them, which takes time to get those jabs into arms. And during that time, the virus can change again. So in so-called poor vaccine matched years for flu, this is what happens. the surveillance is done and the recommendations are made in February or March in the Northern Hemisphere, and then the vaccines are manufactured over the next 6 months until August, September. And by that time, that virus has got 6 months to actually mutate. And sometimes it does. So the vaccines that come out in September, October are virtually useless against the new variant of the virus. And that might happen with COVID as well. COVID doesn't mutate as fast as flu. It's a longer incubation period. So the kind of number of cycles of replication are slightly lower than flu. But you have a lot more people getting COVID who are still not immune, who are totally naive to the virus across the world. And they can be sources to seed new variants into populations that may be fully vaccinated. And those variants may be able to escape those vaccines, or maybe closer, you know, one step, two step genetic difference to actually escape those vaccines in a very big way. And we've seen the Delta plus AY1 variant having acquired the 417N mutation that's in the South African variant that has been one of the most resistant viruses to the vaccines, particularly to the AstraZeneca vaccines that the UK is so proud of. And that's why AstraZeneca is trying to update their vaccine design to include the South African mutations in the coming winter. And Pfizer has decided not to do that, at least so far, and just offers a third dose booster, because that vaccine, the mRNA vaccines, are very broad spectrum and have done better than the AstraZeneca in every real world example that we've seen so far, including the most recent one against the Delta variant in the Scottish population, just published in The Lancet a couple of weeks ago.
So we also know we've got people who are double jabbed and they are still getting coronavirus. Ooh. What's going on there?
So we don't know how well they responded after the second jab, because we don't routinely test them. So 1 in 10 being hospitalized post-double jabs, that could be in the ballpark of those who just failed the vaccine response or have a very minimal vaccine response. And we know that the Delta variant can infect those with a low level of antibody compared to the Wuhan or the Alpha Kent variant. Now, of course, most of them are younger people, but the ones who have been doubly vaccinated have not just been young people. So there is a window there for a potential problem. So if you have 800, of which 80 might be hospitalized with double jabs, if you multiply that up to like 20 million people, 10 or 20 million people, that's a lot of people who could be hospitalized despite having double jabs. So I think the vaccine confidence, I think, is overstated and probably overestimated, especially waning immunity in the older population that were jabbed first, but also the new variants that are escaping around that virus protection by creating new variants like the Delta AY1 variant and some of the others that come in from overseas if we allow international travel. So the vaccination program is always going to be behind new variants and also vaccine failures arising.
I think this is the other thing. I don't think people realize it. So we may be vaccinated here, but you need to vaccinate the world.
Yes.
Because it's still mutating, and that's where, yes, you start to get these new variants coming in.
Yeah, so it's not just the world. So you vaccinate the world, you protect the world, but if you don't vaccinate the children under 18s, they still become a reservoir for new variants. So they're fully susceptible, whether they're in India, Pakistan, Mongolia, New Zealand, a lot of the Southeast Asian countries that control the virus very well are now refusing vaccination, which is the irony of the situation, because they're not so scared of the virus because they've not seen it, but they're scared of the vaccine adverse effects because they've seen it on the news all the time. But statistically and from clinical trials, we know that the risk of the virus causing complications, hospitalizations and deaths is much higher, 10 times higher at least, than the vaccine adverse effects, even in the younger population. And the vaccine obviously matters. So if you've been exposed to maybe different vaccines, some of them which have less data, shall I say, available, then you may have less confidence than, say, some of the more Western vaccines that have had lots of data published. So you can see the adverse effects along with the vaccine efficacy and protective impact against the virus.
So what would your advice be to people if you were going to tell people, you know, your advice based on your years and years of experience looking at these kinds of viruses? What would your advice be to people?
So the vaccine's nearly always safer than the virus. Now, there are some exceptions to this. So we know that the first RSV vaccine had some problems. We know that the first rotavirus vaccine also had some problems and they were withdrawn and nobody dared to touch them for, you know, the 3 decades or so. And then we know that the pandemic virus vaccine, the Pandemrix vaccine made by GSK, I think it was, had a specific effect on those who were predisposed to narcolepsy in Scandinavian children. So there's a genetic predisposition to that, and this vaccine with that adjuvant seemed to open that up. So it's a very specific population that were at risk. So there are some bad stories with vaccines. There are also some false stories with vaccines, like the MMR autism story. And that wasn't proven, but it has seeded a lot of doubt in some people's minds and maybe the driver for some vaccine hesitancy, and certainly the driver for the loss of the measles free status in the UK. And we even have a group of teenagers called the Wakefield Generation, who are around 20 years old now, whose parents refused to give them the MMR vaccine during that time when they were in the first year of life. And now they're susceptible to measles, and that has, there's enough of them to actually propagate measles in the UK, so it's lost its measles-free status, unfortunately. But overall, vaccines are very effective against viruses. And when the virus becomes less and less prevalent, like smallpox, like polio, we change the vaccine to a safer form, like from oral polio vaccine, which had a revertant risk to wild type and causing disease like the wild type, to an inactivated polio vaccine now in the UK, part of the 6-in-1 vaccine package. But also smallpox vaccination was stopped soon after eradication because that had a lot of complications. But you see that most vaccines are very safe compared to the actual virus itself. And that's always a balance you need to be aware of. So if the virus is becoming less prevalent, less of a risk, you've got to look at the vaccines and whether the vaccine is actually more of a risk than the virus itself because of the adverse effects. And that's always the case. And that's what people like JCVI are focusing on before licensing these vaccines as well.
So your suggestion would be for people to get vaccinated. What about masks?
I would voluntarily wear masks indoors in crowded environments if you can, to protect yourself but other people as well, if you can tolerate the mask. And also if you have vulnerable household contacts that you go home to whom you might bring back the virus and for whom vaccine immunity may be waning already, because they'll be double jabbed, but you don't know how well they've responded actually because you didn't ever test them. So there'll always be some exceptions to that, maybe 5 to 10%, as we were saying earlier, with poor or no vaccine responses that could still be vulnerable that you don't know about because you don't test them post-vaccination. So there are lots of loopholes that, if you add them up, can cause a problem for the NHS and for those individual patients if the virus is spreading, you know, fairly rapidly through the population. So living with the virus is an easy phrase, but at what level do you choose to live with the virus? So if everyone's vaccinated, the vaccine will reset that level at which you will live with the virus. But those people who are most vulnerable can choose, if you like, to avoid certain indoor areas, to wear a mask, to stay away from those who might choose not to wear a mask, who might be asymptomatically infected. And those who don't have these vulnerabilities and want to live their life as normal, well, they can do that as well. But, you know, if they can give some consideration to those who can't, well, that's part of society. That's why we live together. And that's what I hope for, because otherwise, you know, why bother living together?
So but the other thing about living with COVID is presumably long COVID.
Yeah, so this is another issue that we're not sure about. So if you have breakthrough infection that leads to long COVID, there is a concern there. Most of the long COVID studies have been done on naive populations that get COVID, mild or moderate or severe, that are followed up for 3 to 6 months or even 12 months now, that develop persistent symptoms that maybe mild, moderate, severe themselves. Not all the symptoms of long COVID stop you from going back to work or living your normal life, but some do. So obviously it's best not to get COVID at all. If you're going to have breakthrough infection post-vaccination, I think the risk is lower. So get vaccinated anyway. But if you have a large population that's unvaccinated, like the under 18s in this country and elsewhere, because not every country's immunizing children, children get long COVID as well. And children who get long COVID badly can't go back to school because they can't remember anything, they can't get out of bed, they've got no physical energy, etc. And we do see something like this with chronic fatigue syndrome, you know, with post-glandular fever, Epstein-Barr virus infections, and Lyme disease, but not at this scale. Okay, so if you're looking at a few hundred cases a year with glandular fever versus a few thousand cases a year with COVID-19, it's a totally different scale of impact on the NHS services. And a lot of this will be shifted to GPs in the community who are already underfunded and overworked anyway. And also social care, which again is underfunded and overworked. So I think long COVID in adults and children is an emerging complication, which we're going to see more of as you open up and use the vaccine to stop hospitalizations and deaths. And the focus in the media may shift towards long COVID as a debilitating consequence of living with the virus.
So what's been the impact of your work so far? What does your research mean for the person on the street?
The thing that we're advocating is that this virus travels with the air that you breathe out. That message has been very hard to get across, particularly in the UK, because there's a very strong traditional belief that everything's by touch and droplets here. And this goes back many years in history, and we've actually written an article about this, how it's come to this stage. If you believe that the virus is transmitted by aerosol, by just talking and breathing the same air, like the garlic breath distance or the burnt toast distance, then having that awareness will make people think about, you know, should I wear a mask? Should I go into that crowded restaurant? Where's the ventilation safety certificate that has been advocated for some convenience stores, for example? So if you go into, say, a kebab shop or a restaurant, you see a food hygiene certificate, and some of us have been advocating there should be a ventilation certificate as well, showing what the ventilation rate is, what is the liters per second per person or air change per hour, okay? And that should be in black and white so you can see, is it safe to go in here with the potential for airborne virus to circulate, especially if you can't wear a mask because you're eating and drinking. So that's the most practical thing we're advocating at the moment. The other thing is about masks. And I think the masking, I'm always trying to give the message that masks work. They do work, both to protect yourself and other people. And if everyone wears a mask, it works even better. And this has been an ongoing theme of mine for the past 12, 16 months, because I've been working with masks and aerosols for the past 20 years. You know, we had papers showing aerosol transmission, well, airflow dynamics of exhaled air, you know, back in 2008, 2009, around the flu pandemic. And then it went quiet for 10 years. And suddenly with COVID, it's come up again. But now people doing new studies and not realizing we've done this already before, like 10 years ago. So I've been advocating the studies that we did 10 years ago and integrating with the current studies that actually say the same thing as we said 10 years ago with the flu pandemic. So it's interesting that we keep reinventing the wheel, and the controversies and the arguments for and against the wheel are still the same, but now just at a much larger level, a global level. And, you know, we had conflicts with WHO in the early days in 2007 or so when we were talking about aerosol transmission. Those conflicts haven't been resolved over the last 10 years. But now with COVID, we are making some headway into saying, look, aerosol transmission as a route of transmission is important. We're not saying it's the only route. You know, touching things, large droplet sprays are important, but aerosols, we think, are predominant in this COVID-19 pandemic because those other interventions are not working. Washing your hands is not working. Large droplet containment is not working. So all you have left is aerosol, garlic breath, and burnt toast.
I love that analogy. Okay, so I'm going to ask you this one. So what's next for you?
So at the moment, I'm really just tracking the interaction of flu with COVID. I've been working with ICU teams looking at the severity of illness from flu, that's a couple of years ago, and now with COVID, first wave, second wave, and later on in winter, the combination of flu and COVID, and then also tracking the impact of the vaccines. So whether we have a third dose booster vaccine only, with no new design, or a redesigned vaccine from AstraZeneca, and then the sequence of flu vaccine and COVID vaccine. Are we going to give them one into both arms at the same time, or COVID-19 first, then flu, because flu is the weaker vaccine, and the COVID-19 vaccine may prime the immune response for a better response to the flu vaccine, or we give flu first and COVID first, and also which order of COVID in the mix and match studies, like AZ first and Pfizer, which seems to be the best way, but Pfizer AZ is also okay, and then it's AZ, Pfizer, and flu, or Pfizer, AZ, and flu, or flu, AZ, and Pfizer, or flu, Pfizer, and AZ. So all these different combinations will come into play, and also the vaccination of children, if it comes in, and the impact of that on the adult population. Because that's really what the, one of the arguments anyway for primary school vaccination, to protect the children, and then you protect the adults they live with and have contact with. Children also can also get very severely ill with flu, but you also protect the adults by immunizing the children. And this is the same argument for, if you like, vaccinating pregnant women, because when you vaccinate pregnant women, they generate antibodies, and then their newborns get those antibodies at delivery for 3 to 6 months and protects them from early neonatal infant flu as well, which can also be devastating. So it's really linked to, again, how the virus is transmitting and spreading, what we can do to actually stop it from transmitting and spreading, and the impact and conflict and interaction of all those different interventions, whether it's vaccine, masking, social distancing. And we now have some antivirals for COVID-19, still only for the severely ill cases. But there are some new drugs being, not new, that repurposed drugs being suggested for prophylaxis, post-exposure prophylaxis, treatment of mild, moderate cases to stop them getting more severe so they don't have to come to hospital. And for flu, we have this. We have things like Tamiflu and Relenza. You can actually use to treat people in the community So all these different interventions are very interesting options for COVID as well. But I think the main thing with COVID that stands out from flu is that you don't get long flu syndrome. At the moment, we see long COVID in children and adults. About 40 to 60% of children and adults can get long COVID from mild, moderate, or severe infection. So that's my other concern and I think something I'll be tracking over the next 6 months as well.
Julian, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm sure I'll be seeing you very soon, not least on my television, as you continue to bring your expertise in light of the coronavirus pandemic.
Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.